Welcome to The Rubric. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
I'm Erica Connell.
And I'm Eric Hsu. Today on The Rubric, we talk with physician developer Johnny Crunch about how IPID fits into the DID ecosystem and how it came to be.
Which systems do you trust to communicate with to get to the ground source of truth?
IPID is the DID method based on IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, the leading decentralized file storage system. Using IPFS as its verifiable data registry, IPID doesn't rely on a blockchain. Instead, it provides a simple and convenient way to use IPFS to resolve an IPID DID to its current DID document.
In the real world, Johnny Crunch is a triple board certified physician with training in internal medicine, medical genetics, and biomedical informatics, with previous academic appointments that include Stanford University and Vanderbilt University. He is also a serial entrepreneur and seasoned executive, having roles as chief medical officer, chief information officer, and chief medical informatics officer at various startup companies. He is also a proficient programmer and is the author of the IPID, Interplanetary Identifiers, DID method. He has been involved with the IPFS, Interplanetary File System, for the past 5 years and is a regular contributor. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with a big, easy question, Johnny. What is DID IPID?
So it's based on IPFS, and I think they probably have to dive into a little bit more of the detail of what IPFS is, IPLD, interplanetary link data, and why all the interplanetary. And so the basis of it, of interplanetary, really has to do with the you address stuff based on its content, not its location. So it, in essence, if it works fine on here, it'll work fine on Mars. So it really is about the standalone nature of the content and the merits of that content, not about who's sharing it or where it is. It's really about what is it. So IPID is really just a pun on the IPFS. Obviously, it's built upon IPFS, but it's a really elegantly simple solution to a DID method that, of course, leverages the IPFS infrastructure. So it really is as simple as publishing your DID document to the IPNS, the Interplanetary Naming System, which is part of the IPFS infrastructure.
So IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, is a file system, as you just said, that indexes based off the content of a document, which means that every update to a document would imply a new identifier.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hash-based content addressing. So if the content changes, the hash will change. And the IPFS is a distributed system for storing, accessing files, websites, applications, and data that is decentralized. There is no central point of failure, and therefore it's also sensor resistant.
Okay. And then there's two other parts, one of which you just touched on, the IPNS, Interplanetary Namespace. And IPLD, which we haven't referenced yet, but Interplanetary Linked Data, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
Maybe mind just digging into these three, IPFS, IPNS, and IPLD, a little bit more and their relation?
Yeah, probably the IPNS, the namespace. And so the namespace is the part of the infrastructure of IPFS. Lower level of IPFS is something called libp2p, or the peer-to-peer networking layer, which is a sort of a wave three or four layer of peer-to-peer broadcasting. So the namespace really is about the public key. So you're publishing content to a value, a key value store in as a DHT, a distributed hash table. And that is the record system in IPFS. Is the key values. The key in this case is the public key, or the hash of the public key, and then the value is what you're putting there. And that would be, in this case, the value of the DID document, or the hash, the CID. And then so those hashes are self-describing, so that those are using something called multi-hashing, multi-base, and multi-codex. So it's self-describing. So it's prepended by bytes that are a lookup table that says what follows is a SHA-256 hash. It's encoded in a base 56, which is the Bitcoin default base encoding representation. And what this content is a raw data. It's binary, for instance. And it's basically also versioned, and this is a version one of a codec that describes it. So if you get that hash and you know that it is a CID, then it describes, batteries included, what you need to do to decode what this information represents.
So how does the link between an IPNS, so when you look up, I take it, is it just called a name in the IPNS? Do you get back then a content address that you could then resolve through IPFS? Is that sort of the flow?
Yeah, so that's in the record system. So that's part of this actually in the DHT, the Kademlia routing, is that basically it's a buckets of storage of key value pairs. In this case, the record includes the signature that, because obviously you need to only trust the issuer of the key that this is associated with. So the public is, it's published to the hash of the public key, and the record includes a signature that validates that this record is signed by the holder of that private key, and that can be easily verifiable. And that is the naming system, which is the key value pair. The key is the hash of the public key, and the record includes the signature associating that record. And then the content is the value that you actually publish there is the value.
And how does Filecoin work with all of this stuff?
So Filecoin is the incentive layer underneath all this. So you don't need to have Filecoin necessarily. So you, if you were to publish this, you need to have a place to store this and resolve this. So that gets into the broader system of IPFS, the interplanetary file system of this pinning nature of the content. So the hash of the content, the CID, exists, but it needs to be pinned. You need to support that. You need to basically replicate it, pin it across different nodes in the network, or have someone replicate it for you on your behalf. And but the Filecoin comes into play, which is the incentive layer, that you don't have to do it yourself. You can basically pay someone else to do it for you in a way that's distributed or decentralized.
I see. So if I can host it myself, then I don't need Filecoin. But if I would like to leverage the Filecoin as a mechanism, then I don't need to host it myself. Filecoin gives me an easy way to pay for hosting to get the storage of the underlying file secured for some period of time.
Exactly. And there's an entire ecosystem and a marketplace for trades of that nature, a storage network. But the IPID does not necessarily rely on that. That is actually is a mechanism to incentivize or to have a decentralized way of having people be encouraged, or if you can marketplace a payment for that. DID documents actually are relatively quite small, at least right now, with about 1 KB on average. I'm sure they can grow as we get larger and larger public keys, or you have to maintain all your list of your keys. But a 1 KB is would be trivial to store on if you were to pay for it with Filecoin. But it's probably important to note that this is actually not part of the IPID system. You could do this completely on your own, or there are pinning services out there, including Pinata, for instance. And I think it's pinata.io, who will pin up to 1 GB of files for you for free.
Oh, all right.
Could you walk us through the standard life cycle of a DID IPID? First, how you would create it and the associated DID document, and then how it gets published to IPFS and subsequently updated.
Yeah, so the content of the DID document is up to the DID author. And this is something that's quite slightly different than the other DID methods, so that you would have to have software to generate the DID document, to create the right structure of the required fields. That would be like the ID section, obviously the public key section, the other relative pieces of that. So you'd actually create that on your own. And then once you actually have that as, let's say, as a JSON file, a JavaScript object notation representation of that DID document. In IPID, it's as simple as let's say you can cat that or echo that into the command line. If you know how to do that, you basically you're piping it into like from the terminal and you pipe it into IPFS. And there's two different ways. The preferred way is to, let's say you cat the file, that JSON file, and you pipe it to IPFS DAG put, and that puts the JSON file into the format, serializes it, performs a canonical representation of the JSON file, and then creates the CID. The output of that would be the CID. And then you take that CID, the content identifier, and you publish it to your IPNS namespace. So you do IPFS name publish, and that CID. And that, in a nutshell, is creating a IPID DID document and publishing it to be as an IPID DID method.
So you generate the DID document yourself as the first step, and then using either Echo or curl, but presumably there would be software libraries out there that you could use as well to get the CID, this content identifier, which is then published to the namespace of the interplanetary namespace. And that's essentially it.
Correct.
I got something lost in there. So we create the document. I get that. We generate the CID. I get that. But I'm getting lost between the publication to the IPNS, which is secured by some public key, and then I think it's separately going to IPFS to actually be stored on the network. Am I following or I'm misunderstanding?
Yeah, so you'd actually need to have it. So you're publishing it to your IPNS, which is basically creating a document, a record that includes your cryptographic signature. That gets stored into your repository, your local repository that runs IPFS. Now, to propagate it into the network, you need to make it discoverable. You need to, basically, let's say we want to pin it across seven continents, or we're going to use Filecoin to incentivize someone on each continent to actually to pin it and make it available. That basically publishes that record into the DHT, the distributed hash table, to make it discoverable. And so it only will be discovered if it's queried and someone goes to look for it in the routing of the Candemula routing, which is then a bitwise exchange would occur of actually retrieving that document. So, but the DHT is a key value pair that actually is, if you're familiar with Candemula K-buckets, is basically in a distributed fashion, the certain number of peers hold certain number of key value pairs in memory as part of the distributed hash table. So it's just the key, in this case, is the hash of the public key, and the value is that CID that represents a pointer to the DID document.
So I think I follow that, but then don't we still have to publish the actual document to IPFS?
You make the document available on your computer system, on your network of computers, or let's say your the systems that have it pinned, and it's discoverable when you go to retrieve it.
Okay, and does that making it available on my server via IPFS, that happens before I publish to IPNS or after?
Correct, before.
Before. Okay.
So you have to create the document and you save the document as let's say a JSON file. You put it, meaning you serialize it, you canonicalize it, because you have to do it to a specific order. It's deterministic. And that saves it to your local IPFS node. And then you publish that CID, the output of that file, to your IPNS record system. And then if your node is online, it's discoverable. And depending on which nodes you're talking to, this could be a public network, or it could be a private network, or it could be a network that lives on Mars. So the juju, the magic juju of distributed nature is that which systems do you trust to communicate with to get to the ground source of truth? But this distributed fashion of it is that it will work perfectly fine on Mars as it does today. It's the interplanetary system.
So essentially, you generate locally, and then once you're ready to publish, you can choose which IPNS to essentially publish your record to. And anyone then that can get to that namespace can look up where your document is and get routed to your actual document.
Yep. So it's important to actually, the key piece of this underlying infrastructure is the peer-to-peer nature of the communication. And there's multiple different protocols of the communication of nodes talking to nodes. Each one is a peer. There's no such thing as a client server or master slave in this sort of model. It's everyone in this network is a peer, and you default to communicating to a certain number of peers. And there's a list of about 20 of them that actually are bootstrap nodes. And those bootstrap nodes aren't actually IPFS. Those are libp2p nodes. And as you're probably aware, like the Ethereum 2.0 protocol is moving towards using libp2p as the underlying chat or the gossip protocol of
the gossip network. Yeah.
The gossip network.
Exactly. I did not know that, but that's good to know.
So depending, and you can communicate and you can bootstrap with a list of known peers or publicly published peers or the default peers that are actually in the system. But you can edit that list and actually communicate with the only ones that the ones that you trust or a certain segment of the ones that you trust, or it could be a private network of peers, or it could be done over a carrier pigeon. The protocol of communication of the libp2p doesn't matter. There are obviously TCP/IP communication. There's a TLS, I think 1.3 now is implemented. There's the Google Noise protocol. You can do WebSockets, you can do carrier pigeon if you actually like it, or you can do satellites.
If you can find any of those.
Yes. So you can actually, and actually we did do it at IPFS camp, actually did an experiment with a satellite dish of communication. Cool. And not to mention Bluetooth. So actually you can communicate over IPFS over Bluetooth. So the protocol of exchange or discovery of the network is there's multiple different streams of protocols to communicate one peer with another peer, but the nature of it is that that's all modular. And so that however you actually want to exchange information and also however you actually want to wait for a delay for a response. So if you actually want to, let's say if it's on Mars and you know it's going to take 30 minutes for it to go round trip to Mars and you're willing to wait that 30 minutes, then you set up a satellite dish, you have a protocol that speaks satellite, and you have a node that's sitting on Mars, and you're waiting to communicate with a node that's at Mars that you know is trusted. The only way that you actually can get a response back is that it's encrypted and the traffic is communicating, being sent from the peer that has the right key signing traffic from the node that's actually on Mars.
I'd like to clarify how did IPID is secured, given what you just said about arbitrary communication channels at the network layer. And I think I know, I want to present a hypothesis or a theory. I think the way it's secured is the public keys in IPNS are what secure the link between a particular identifier and a particular content identifier, which you then get via IPFS. But over IPFS, it's all peer-to-peer, and there isn't a particular mechanism to secure access to any particular piece of content.
So everything is done by public-private key cryptography. So if the IP, going back to the IPRS, the interplanetary record system, that key value pair has to be signed by the private key associated with the hash of the public key. So that record is only valid if it actually has a valid signature. So that means that as part of this, the hash of your DID method specific identifier is the hash of that private key. The hash of that public key that signs that record. At least that has to be one of the records, one of the keys that has to be in order to do a fully validated round trip. That the content of a key in your public key array includes one of the keys that actually is signing the key for your record associated with the IPID. But there are other systems out there. So the default right now has moved away from RSA to ED25519, which is the default key now in the IPFS infrastructure. But the libp2p, given the nature of Ethereum 2.0, SECP256K1 is also supported in the libP2P infrastructure. And I know at least, I think Polkadot system is actually using the SECP256K1 curve to do records signing, et cetera. So that should be on the horizon.
Seems like the security of any DID IP ID is only going to be as good as the trusted nodes. As far as an individual, I can trust a set of nodes within the IPNS space, which would seem to imply that for especially bespoke networks, like a large corporation that wants to set up, say, an IPFS system internally, it could provide high levels of security. But once you go public, you start to have to make a lot of the same choices as you do in, say, like the DNS type of world.
Yeah, although it all boils down to the validation of that cryptographic signature. So what you think you're speaking to is what's called an eclipse attack. And so the eclipse attack is that you basically segregate a network and that you're unable to, or the individual who owns that public key is segregated from the rest of the network. And so you're fooling your, going back to the validator, you're fooling the validator. So there's Alice and Bob, and then you have the V, the validator, who's actually trying to, let's say the TSA agent is trying to validate a signature. So you're trying to segregate the validator from the holder and prevent them from updating a record. But the, given the name, you have to do that at a pretty large scale to disrupt the DHT. So the way the Kademula routing table works is something called K-buckets. And so it's using the edit distance, or the bytewise distance that jumps from one K-bucket to the next K-bucket, and you get closer and closer and closer to the person who actually holds that content, in this case, the hash of the public key. So you need to know the topology of your network to have a way to, the adversary would be to segregate that network, and that's very difficult to do. And that's beyond my understanding as far as the cryptography or networking engineering that would be required, other than it's very, very hard.
And the difficulty only increases as the network size increases then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Johnny, you're a triple board certified physician. I'm interested in how, but maybe more importantly, why? Why did you get involved in programming?
Yeah, so as part of my master's program, my master's thesis was to do biomedical informatics. So my background mostly is in bioinformatics. So mirroring my experience as a geneticist with the need for informatics is doing next-gen sequencing alignment, interpretation of reports, the Human Genome Project, et cetera. So I went back to school and I got my master's in biomedical informatics, and the taxpayers, thank you very much, paid me to go back to school. And I took a huge pay cut from being a doctor to taking classes with 18-year-olds in CS101, learning Java. I had some programming experience before in medical school, and mostly JavaScript and HTML. And then learned Java, C++, and then PHP, then Python. I love Python. I still use Python every day. And then Go and Rust lately are my other two favorite languages. But so I did in medical informatics, like I mentioned, is that informatics is really about creating methods, not just about storing the information, but deriving new insights from the information. So in bioinformatics, it's really is about writing new pipelines for sequence alignment and interpretation of the human genome, which is very computationally intensive. So what is the projects that I worked on in my master's thesis and when I was in faculty was in bioinformatics and the merger with family history. So as a clinical geneticist, family history is really important for the phenotype information. So how do we represent your family tree, your pedigree, for instance? And that was a part of my master's thesis. But after I left academia, I was interested in genetic sequencing. So myself and the founder created a sequencing lab. So we started off in cancer testing, deciding treatment selection for chemotherapy based on the tissue tumor profile. That got to be just too expensive. And so we focused on, mostly from a startup standpoint, of raising capital in order to go through the whole FDA approval for our sequencing lab. So we decided to focus on genetic sequencing of food, and particular dog food. So we still actually support sequencing of dog food for food fraud. And as part of that, I did all the bioinformatics algorithms. So we have a novel approach to sequencing that required a novel pipeline. So I wrote that from scratch using a Python. And then, but it got me interested in IPFS only because I had to manage 55,000 genomes in a database for the startup company. And it got me thinking there's got to be an easier way to store this information. So I started writing my own, which was written in or MD5 hash, if you're familiar with that. Only to realize that there's someone else has got to have done this, and discovered IPFS. So this is about 2015. And ultimately, the problem that we were trying to solve with the food fraud detection was really about testing, that someone in the pipeline had done testing. So it got me interested in blockchain solutions to solve this. And so this is 2015, 2016, Bitcoin, blockchain, Ethereum was just brand new at that time. So it really got me interested in presenting a document to the supply chain that proved that genetic testing had been done and validated and on some sample of the payload. And so we built that, that was in 2016, but it really started off my interest in the IPFS project, that these were really smart people, and I started contributing and attending the weekly calls and talking about use cases, and really took a deep dive into IPFS and then into blockchains and Bitcoin and cryptography after that.
So out of all that, obviously you started working on Did IPID. So how, I guess, what was the use case that really drove you into needing this new identifier?
So I was at the ONC, the Office of the National Coordinator, meeting for this. There's a white paper challenge from Health IT, the government had a white paper call for what were the use cases of blockchain in healthcare. And at that conference, this is 2016 or 17, I guess, one of the people who presented was Drummond Reed, who obviously is in the sovereign and indie world, as well as Manu Spoonie. And they talked about this idea of decentralized identifiers and just piqued my interest as far as this is like where I think an interesting field of verifiable credentials would meet the needs of what I had in the food fraud document delivery blockchain solution that we were building. So I attended that meeting and was intrigued by decentralized identifiers. I actually, that 3 months or 2 months later, actually participated in a hackathon. So you mentioned I'm a programmer. One of the I love to do is attend hackathons. It's just really to challenge myself to do a deep dive. And so I attended a hackathon at the Distributed Health Conference in Nashville, Tennessee. And the weekend hackathon, if you're familiar, is like a 24-hour stay awake, code as much as possible and present what you worked on. And I had hoped to work on a solution for verifiable vaccinations. And really, because at the time was a Hurricane Irina, I think, has just gone through Florida. And the state of Tennessee had suspended the laws for the practice of medicine and will allow any doctor from any state to take care of any patient if they were a refugee from Florida during the hurricane. And so that was the weekend. That was actually the weekend of this hackathon. And so the got me thinking as far as like one of the sort of like hello world of healthcare and healthcare IT is vaccinations. And so back when I used to teach students and medical students the introduction to biomedical informatics course when I was on faculty, like creating a proof of vaccination or just basically a table of your vaccinations was like the hello world that we actually used to teach the students. So that weekend was a hello world of like basically let's do verifiable vaccinations as a verifiable credential. And as part of that, I needed a DID method. And so I downloaded, installed Project Indy, which was now part of the Hyperledger project. But I was frustrated because it didn't do what I needed it to do. I just needed a DID method, quick and simple, to do my verifiable vaccinations to show the hack what I did over the weekend. And in the end, it was at the time was very simple. Hello Alice, hello Bob. And behind it was used Plenum for the fault tolerant the BFT, Byzantine fault tolerant consensus algorithm. And I looked at the code and realized what they're trying to do was really about this DHT, this distributed hash table. And I scratched my head and said, oh yeah, I've seen this before. This is basically IPRS or interplanetary record system. And so instead of writing or trying to understand like their messy code, I basically just realized I could just publish this to IPFS and call it an IP, a DID method. And did that over the weekend, demoed it. And now obviously verifiable credentials are kind of like a big deal as the use case for vaccine or vaccines are a driving use case for verifiable credentials. But then a few weeks later, I flew out to Boston and presented the work to the Rebooting Web of Trust meeting. I think it was number 7 that was in Boston, and that was in 2017.
Who else was involved, Johnny? Was this mostly you as a Lone Ranger, or did you have some allies and Confederates?
Just me for that weekend. There was a whole bunch of projects that we could have done. I was busy that day and actually honestly didn't do the whole 24 hours. And I'm getting old and not willing to stay up. And so I hacked that together, and that was just me that weekend.
Are there people you're working with now, continuing the IPID work, or who is continuing it now and going into the future?
Yeah, so it really is stands on its own. And so it's not like it's not supposed to be controlled by any company or blockchain. So it's, as I mentioned, blockchain agnostic. So you can use blockchains with IPID if you choose to and actually want to have an added layer of security, but doesn't have to. So there are companies that have licensed some of the code that I have created to actually support it. There are people who've created their own methods or own software on top of IPID. I think I mentioned Andre Cruz from the labs, the Matter Labs, I guess, in Portugal. Then there was Alberto, who was attended the conference, one of the conferences with us in the Rebooting Web of Trust. He's working on a distributed VR platform and wanted the lightweight DID method. And there's some people in Australia who've licensed it too for distributed digital rights management software. And then there are other companies that actually are starting up with more of a wallet sort of a solution centered around key management. Because in the end, all of these DID methods really require a wallet and key management software.
So talk to me about the wallets. Given that you talked about curl and other sort of Linux command line-y ways to interact with IPFS, I'm guessing you're using command line key generation tools at this stage. Is the next step having or getting this supported by sort of more GUI-like wallets?
Yeah, you can. And so there are some web-based key management software. So it gets into a slippery slope, though, because key management of Bitcoin, your Bitcoin wallet or your Ethereum wallet, or now your identity, it gets into the tricky business of maintaining the security around that. And I don't know about you, but I'm pretty paranoid about my Bitcoin and Ethereum and now my Filecoin wallet as far as like how to keep that private. So I think a lot of this DID methods are really going to be centered around that keeping that wallet secure. There are methods in IPFS. So right now, most of that goes into a .ipfs file. And so, but that's up to the user to actually to store that, to do some magic to switch around the keys so that basically it's not in the clear in your .ipfs. Although I think the latest version, the .0.9 version of IPFS actually has that now encrypted by default. I should probably mention that IPFS is still in beta. So IPFS is still version 0.9 as of this week, I believe. So that there's still, you know, a lot of lessons learned and still not quite ready for like the first release. But the proper way, in my opinion, would be either a hardware wallet or a cold wallet that basically you perform those signatures in an offline device. You know, I've got to the point where I have a whole different laptop that I actually use that's offline, that doesn't have any of my, that I want to do any of my transactions. And like, at least from Christopher Allen's taught me that you keep a cold offline wallet and you should be sufficiently paranoid.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that approach.
Yeah. And so when it gets into like, well, what's your level of paranoia or what's your level of security? And that's up to you to decide how well you either want to encrypt and back up your keys or perform an offline signature for your DID method, for your, meaning your DID document. The IP ID is, we're not controlling your keys. We're not controlling creation of the DID document. I don't own IP ID. I published it as, hey, here's a simple hack to actually for publishing a DID document. The other companies and vendors can actually come up with a wallet solution for performing that those actions for you. But this is an elegantly simple, at least I think, is an elegantly simple approach.
I think that this discussion leads well into something we talked about actually in our pre-production call, that you brought up the importance of understanding not only the specification for any of these DID methods, but also the implementation, and particularly the specific implementation that you want to use or make use of, which I think ties well into this notion of managed wallets or hot wallets, as they're often called. So I just wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe speak a little bit to the importance of kind of knowing your implementation of any of these cryptographic systems.
Yep, important. So you want me to dive into more detail? But as I mentioned, I think it is, it's as secure as you want it to be. So it's your methods. You can actually, like, for instance, I have a PIV card, or like, you know, you like just basically PGP keys. And so how well do you keep your PGP key safe? And so yeah, PGP, of course, is pretty good protection. It's been going back 20, 30 years. So the public key infrastructure that we use for PGP keys is not new. It's been around for a long time. So how do we keep those keys private and secure? And I have different various methods. I unfortunately actually have one that's under Johnny Crunch from 1997. And I actually, at the time, didn't really quite understand. I was just playing with it and never created an expiration date. So, of course, that was actually published in the MIT server. And I think it might still be in the MIT server, but I never created an expiration date. Now I've actually gotten to now understanding it and being more astute is actually there are I rotate my keys for my PGP, but this public key infrastructure is no different. This is basically the same idea that we've had for 20, 30 years. The only difference is that there's not a centralized server to actually to sharing them. It is like up to me, the author, to actually share that DID document and be as secure as I want to about rotating my keys, saving my keys, backing up my keys, and encrypting my keys for my purposes. Some I actually have on a PIV card, which is a personal ID card. I can't remember what the I and the V stand for, but basically it's like a government chip card. And so like you get from Estonia. I have ones that are on hardware security modules. I have, you know, one that's in my phone, you know, obviously one that's baked into my laptop. And, you know, and then there's the hardware wallets for instance, that, you know, that you can use as well.
Is there anything in particular you would recommend when someone was maybe looking for a piece of wallet software to use? Is there anything that you look for in particular in wallet software? Or is it mostly just have to do your own due diligence and dig into it yourself?
Yeah, I think ultimately that's up to the end user to be as paranoid as you want it to be and also as convenient as you want it to be. So I still struggle with myself and my wife is like, you know, my crypto, for instance, is like, I don't know, I have a good mechanism to share it with my wife, for instance, right now, because I think, you know, she would save it in her contact list if she could. And so I don't think that there would be a good mechanism to save the private key associated with my wallets. So I have different mechanisms, including offline wallets. And so but depends what I'm storing. And so is it like, is it my pseudo identity, Johnny Crunch? Is it my professional credentials for my medical license?
Are you trying to secure your life savings over here? Or is it just for fun spending?
So, and it's no different from my password. So I have password management software, and obviously I'm probably more advanced user, and I have more advanced mechanisms to keep things backed up. But in the end, it's just a secret. So how do you keep track of your secrets? I would recommend backing it up. I think, as some author said, that you should tattoo it on your scrotum or someplace private.
At least you wouldn't forget where that happened.
Yeah.
So there's other ways.
I think that Christopher Allen actually has his titanium plates that he's demoed before. There's writing them down and sharding them with Snorre's signatures and sharing it with X number of friends and having a mechanism to recreate them. There's all sorts of ways of actually storing the private key. The interesting thing is actually they're quite small compared to other, you know, secrets. And so it's relatively easy to create a good method for backing them up and encrypting them and storing them.
Johnny, what were the complications you faced in trying to get IPID working? Either technical challenges you overcame or personnel or political dynamics?
Oh, yeah. So political for sure. So I think what we started to talk about is that when you publish the document, it's you can write it in JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. But in order to canonicalize it, to make it deterministic, so you basically get the same hash no matter what the ordering of the keys are, it transforms it into CBOR. So concise binary object representation, which is actually a superset of JSON. And so there's all sorts of controversy in the working group that we're involved in about supporting CBOR, not supporting CBOR. There's a new approach called CBOR LD for CBOR linked data, which is just emerging to be a specification. And so there's all sorts of just nuances of, well, people want to make it simple. They just want to do JSON. JSON is limited because it's not a byte representation, it's a string representation. So you get slightly different ordering depending, and you have to validate, you need a normalization algorithm. So I've been advocating CBOR all along, which is a superset of JSON to make it canonical but that has been an uphill battle. So in the current version of the IPID DID method, there is a reference to a slash. That slash is supposed to represent the tag 42, which is represents a CID. So basically is the batteries included, self-descripting model of what this thing comes after it is supposed to say that this is a CID. So you can do that in CBOR, and it's harder to do in JSON. So as part of my task now, since we're on the podcast, is to go back and actually update that document, which is now 2.5 years old, to be more conformant with the now published DID specification. So certainly, I think political challenges. I don't think necessarily technical. So the subtleties of the method really are as simple as using IPFS, and you can write lightweight IPFS nodes that do only certain of those tasks without actually having to running a full node and share all that data. Mostly, I guess it would be just the political, non-technical.
You have mentioned that the specification itself is a little bit out of date. And is there a timeline for the next version?
Sure. Let me give myself a week.
Great. So you might have it done before we go to press with this podcast.
Yeah, I think the details of the documentation just talks about creating and updating and deleting it. And so, but the subtleties of as it stands now, the IPID document can stand, and it is conformant. And the reason being is that there's we all agreed with a resolution on the DID working group that it is a key by default paradigm, that if there's something that is not registered in DID spec registries, or something that doesn't conform to the specification, you have to keep it in. So that means things like the example I give is in previous, which is a key or a property in the DID document that I give an example of, or the slash that represents the tag 42 CID that basically prepends it and just allows you to describe the following content as a CID. Those actually will be passed by default, meaning even though it's not fully conformant, that any DID method or resolver can't remove those, that those should be retained. So they're basically sprinkling of additional information. So the previous property, we didn't dive into this in much detail, but IPLD, interplanetary link data, is basically a DAG, a directed acyclic graph. Having the benefit of a previous field gives you a pointer to the previous version of the DID document. So as you make revisions, and basically there's always a pointer to the previous one. That's step number one, that adds some security. The second piece is something as an anchor field. And that anchor is that if you, as I mentioned, IPID does not use a blockchain by default, but you can use blockchains to anchor the proof of existence of your DID document at a given method, a time, different specified time. And the reason why that's valuable is that you want the ability to walk back in time and show that this DID document and the public key associated with, let's say, a verifiable credential existed at a certain point in time. And that's where blockchains are really handy, is that actually having a sequential ordering of events that you can go back, let's say, 10 years prior and verify that this, yes, this key existed non-reputably. Because otherwise, if you're just basically appending each key to the array and the final version of your DID document is basically the final version, and you just say you don't have a blockchain underpinning it that you can actually can audit, then all you're doing is trusting the latest version of the DID document. So it really is what we call a side tree approach to blockchain technology, which is really a lightweight, directed acyclic graph, very similar to how blockchains work, which is a pointer to the previous block. But in this case, it's a pointer to the previous version of the DID document, and ideally with an anchor as well, that of a proof of existence. Now you can, I've done this with experimenting with a proof of existence smart contracts. In fact, actually the default Ganache, which is the sort of developer tools for Ethereum, has a default proof of existence smart contract that just publishes it bytes to. And so that basically is one example of doing it. And the other one is the open timestamp protocol, which is Peter Todd, one of the Bitcoin core developers, has a protocol that does open timestamps. And it does a similar side tree approach of rolling up a number of Merkle DAGs and including that into, I believe, an op return in the Bitcoin blockchain.
So the very next step is to update this specification to be conformant with the DID core specification, which is on the cusp of being published by the W3C. Is there something after that? Is there an IPID 2.0? Or where do you continue in this work? If IPID is done and on a shelf and good to be used, what's next?
Yeah, I think, personally, it's the next step of this is the key management. And how do you rotate your keys? How do you do, let's say, M of N signatures? So basically, you want to have a key sign this. And so also, how does this play into the IPFS ecosystem with libP2P? And support for, let's say, the SECP256K1 curves in the records. So I think it really is continuing the work and helping out the IPFS community to bolster the use of IPID in the ecosystem. I would love to see IPID as sort of like the default DID method for all of the identity systems that we need in IPFS and Filecoin.
Very cool. Well, this conversation has definitely inspired me to consider using DID IPID for an application we're developing. I had already pretty much said, hey, you know, DID Web's an easy starting point. But it doesn't feel like DID IPID is much more work. I mean, I have to figure out how to plug into IPFS and the IPNS, but those are existing systems and there are APIs and libraries for it. So it seems like it might be an easy lift for that application.
Before we get to our wrap up, is there anything that you wanted to touch on that we might have missed here?
Yeah, I think I'll probably just put a plug in for PRs. Pull requests are welcome on the DID method. And I think you'll put some a link into the show notes. But I think it is referenced in the DID specification or the DID spec registries as a list. And the IPID is a pointer to the IPID DID method. And so if people actually want to take a look at it and to give feedback or suggestions for improvements, the PRs are welcome.
It's actually now time for our shameless plug segment of the podcast.
I have one, Erica, which I'm stealing what you may have done if you had thought about it, which is my shameless plug is for the Dave Matthews Band. In particular, I guess it was just yesterday, Erica, they performed their first concert in 520 days. And it was broadcast widely by fans. It was fun and it was beautiful. And we'll get through this COVID thing one way or another. And thanks, Dave, for getting back up on stage and sharing the joy of music.
Thanks, Dave. Yes, it was Friday night, their first concert, I think. But there was so much excitement over a crowd being able to get together. But I did have that feeling like, I don't know. Might be a little early for that kind of gathering.
Was he at one of the only vaccinated allowed venues?
I don't know. That's a great question. I hope so.
Yeah, I know a lot of places were doing that.
Yeah, I think even though I wrote the verifiable credentials use case for verifiable vaccinations, I still have reservations about it. And as a doctor, like, I don't know if that should be a driving use case for verifiable credentials, because it stirs up a whole bunch of social economic controversies, and that I feel uneasy about. And I think, and even though I wrote one, I have one that works on my phone that I wrote. It's that you of course use as IPID, but it is there's the social dilemma of actually the technology, and I think and what I've learned in my experience working with IPFS. For instance, what really is one of my passions of being involved in the project is the censorship resistance. So as Joe and I actually had the discussion about this while we're in Barcelona, I think, talking about how IPFS supported the uprising of the District of Catalonia, which is where Barcelona is located, and the referendum voting for independence. And so huge amounts of protests and et cetera. And what the IPFS community did was we were able to replicate the voting information to allow people to find out where they're gonna vote, to encourage people to make their own decision, but to enable the democracy to occur. So IPFS by nature is a censorship resistant protocol. And that, I think, it sort of speaks to this decentralized or distributed nature of self-sovereignty, that I have control over my own identity. I have control over my own document or my public keys, and there's no central point of failure. So the same thing with Turkey. So the Turkey Wikipedia site, when there's an uprising in Turkey, they turned off Wikipedia. Can you imagine a country where they turn off Wikipedia because they don't want people to have access to it? So what we did in IPFS was we backed it up, and the entire Wikipedia, including the Turkish version of Wikipedia, is now on IPFS. So it speaks to the distributed nature of this. And the same thing is happening in China right now, which is that there's the Great Wall of China. Well, when you have a protocol agnostic communication via satellite or Starlink or you name it, censorship becomes a lot harder. And I think that really, in my mind, facilitates true self-sovereignty and really democracy in general.
Yeah, I love that. One distinction I'd offer to the conversation about VCs for vaccine records or vaccination passports or whatever, I actually think it's a great use case, not because the proposed solutions solve the social problem, but because it teaches us a lot when we understand how it fails. So VCs do some things right, but all these other problems aren't quite addressed. And so that, to me, makes it very useful to understand better where we need to take this technology.
Yeah. And it's highlighted me the risks of correlation. So even in, let's say, other DID methods like DID peer, for instance, where you're basically creating one peer ID for each relationship. Well, what's the risk for correlation in, let's say, the restaurants or healthcare? Let's say I'm involved in healthcare use cases right now where they actually want to do correlation across all your identifiers. Well, that kind of gives me pause as far as like, well, that's what exactly we're trying to avoid with the DID methods. So I think, so it just gives me pause as far as like, this is a slippery slope of how these will be used And I guess Kubernetes also speaks to the underlying decentralized nature of it. And it really reminds me of Tim Berners-Lee. So at the Rebooting Web of Trust, I actually had the honor of meeting Tim Berners-Lee. And unfortunately, I pissed him off when I first met him. And the reason being was that I was, at the time, Joe, if you remember, Christopher Allen was asking about what are the hidden signals we're not talking about with Rebooting Web of Trust. What is a Web of Trust? And I sort of rose my hand and talked about porn. And you don't talk about porn in polite conversation. So I was talking to about basically how every technology actually has its moments. And in the porn industry, it was beta versus VHS. Or you just think about how porn has been a major driver for video codecs, web payment models, and drives 30% of all internet traffic. And it's not that I'm advocating that DIDs should basically go after the porn industry. I'm just saying, like, these are social implications of our technology that we should be aware of. And so, but I left it with Tim not wanting to talk to me. I went up to him afterwards and just tried to jokingly say, like, explain myself. But he was all flustered and actually wouldn't talk to me. He's one of my heroes.
That's too bad.
But it really is about the social implications of our technology, and we need to sort of understand those and be mindful of those before we actually just embrace them willy-nilly and sort of run down the road with them.
Other than IPID, what is your favorite DID method?
I guess DID key. So it's basically, it's inline. So it's basically one-off key.
It's a popular answer.
It's simple, elegant, one-off key that actually uses multi-codecs, which is part of the IPFS project.
Excellent. Well, hopefully by the time this gets published, we will have published our episode that is covering DIDKEY. So look for that. If you're listening to this, go check out our episode about DIDKEY.
And that will bring us to the end of our show today.
Thank you, Johnny, for joining us today. Thanks also to our staff, our producer, Eric O'Connell, and our co-host, Eric Hsu. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
Wherever you find the Rubrik podcast, please take a moment to subscribe to our feed so you'll be notified when our next episode is released. We look forward to you joining us next time. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the speakers in this podcast belong solely to the speakers and not necessarily to the speaker's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual.